Hey, everybody, welcome to a special bonus episode of the Who Goes There podcast, where I'm going to be catching up with one of my previous guests. So I am very pleased to be rejoined by Keith Law. Hi there, Keith.
Hello.
It has been more than 4 years since I had you on the podcast. That was episode 15. I've now got 69 episodes out. So
nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Has it really been 4 years?
It has been 4 years, yeah.
Well, there has been a whole pandemic in the interim.
Yes. The reason that I'm having you on is I have 6 books left to read to finish the list. But okay. I became aware that you were probably at the end of your list because I heard you make a snarky comment about the Mars series on the Athletic Baseball Show. And I thought, I'm pretty sure he's saving those ones for last. So
yeah. Oh, yeah. I absolutely did.
Yeah. Wow. But I did want to mention before we start, though, you know, in those 4 years, there's been some changes in your life, new employer, at least. Anything you want to talk about there?
Yes. Yeah. So I am now at The Athletic. I have been here for closing in on 3 years now, which is also amazing. I joined right before the pandemic started. Job is generally the same, like in terms of what it looks like to readers, except you have to subscribe to a different site. And obviously since then we've been acquired by the New York Times, but I will say it hasn't really changed for me much. Things are good. I love it where I am. I am getting ready to go out to Arizona for a fall league trip pretty soon, which is great. It's one of my favorite things to do every year. I'm still doing mostly the same stuff, which I like. I really enjoy what I do.
Yeah.
Enjoy the mix of responsibilities. And it's funny, a couple people have asked me, do you miss doing television? A little bit. It was mostly a hoot because like my niece and nephew would see me on TV and get, you know, when Uncle Cookie was on TV, that was very exciting. You know, also like, what are they going to do? Watch me 50 times? Like after a while, it's like, oh great, he's on TV again.
Right.
It's not that interesting. Also now, like I was on MLB Network the other day from my house, from right where I'm sitting talking to you also. So like the whole world's changed.
Yes.
And I'm pretty good where I am.
Well, it's nice, you know, for fans of your podcasting, because you still have, you have the Keith Law Show, and then we hear you every week on with DVR, which is cool.
Yep. So,
oh, and Bias Cat.
Bias Cat. Is he trying to leave? Oh my God, you jerk. He literally came in because I closed the door. Hold on. Let me open the door. He's going to do this the entire time.
Nice.
So for folks who don't know, I have a three-legged cat. His actual name is Hexie. But there is a running gag, 10-year-plus running gag about Bias Cat. Every time you accuse me of hating your favorite team, God kills a kitten. Right. And somehow that became Bias Cat. And multiple cats have filled the role of Bias Cat over the years. We have recast it as cats have passed on.
It's not a title. It's a name. Not a name. It's a title. Right. Yeah.
It's a title. Yeah. Yes. It is not hereditary. It is by appointment. But we are unfortunately down to one cat now, and that is him. And he does not like a closed door at all.
Nice. Yeah. My dogs are the same way. They're quite vocal about it if I try and close the podcast door. But nobody else is in the house today. So as long as the UPS truck doesn't show up and, you know, threaten the nuclear apocalypse or whatever it is they react to, then we should be fine. So... back 4 years ago when we were talking, I asked you for any positive vibes about the Mariners, and you didn't really have any. So it's kind of fun that now we're talking about it the day after they advanced to the division series in 2020.
Oh, they didn't just advance, right? Second biggest playoff comeback in history. I was watching it.
Yeah, that was a tremendous game. I mean,
oh my God.
My son and I were texting each other back and forth because he's down in Texas. And I'd been talking about going down there to catch a game with him if they advance. And we're like, it looks like it's not going to happen this time. Because I hadn't bought tickets yet. Because I wanted to wait until at least they won game one. And then I was like, then I'm going to have to get refundable tickets. And so then when they were down 8-1, I texted him. I'm like, well, you know, at the very least, maybe they can make their bullpen work. So game three is a little easier. You know, if they mount a comeback here, it'd be awesome.
Right.
And little did I know there was some expletives going back and forth on text.
Oh my God.
So that was exciting.
Amazing. Amazing game.
So like I said, I've still got 6 books left on my kind of odyssey reading through the Hugo list. I know you finished. Did you say you hadn't read the newest one yet?
No. Okay. Arkady Martine's, what is it, A Desolation Called Peace? God, I hate the titles of her books. Like the whole thing. I didn't love the first book. What was it, A Memory Called Empire? Mm-hmm. I mean, I find the titles pretentious. Mm-hmm. And I didn't love it.
Okay.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I didn't hate it. We're going to talk about some books I hated. Okay. But I didn't love it. And I was disappointed to see it won again. I'm like, doing anything really new here, right? Sure. And that is a Hugo. We can talk about that. There is a bit of a thing with the Hugos too, where they tend to reward familiar authors quite a bit, and often, sometimes they deserve it, but often they don't.
Yeah. And so, you know, what I want to do is I do want to just talk in general about, you know, what's the experience been like reading through the list? Was it a worthwhile thing to do for you?
It's highly debatable. but I will say, no, I wanted to do, I'm very much a completionist at heart anyway.
Yeah.
And so I'm certainly glad I did it. I'm also glad it's sort of done, right? I had to read a bunch of duds and now I don't necessarily have that anymore. But yeah, I am glad I did, because also I enjoy reading fiction tremendously. I've also read all the Pulitzer Prize winners, for the novel, and now it's the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. And I've read something like 2/3 of the Booker Prize winners. And it is, part of it is just completionism, and that I like to have a list to work off of. It helps me when I go to books, when I go to Changing Hands in Phoenix this month. I have a couple spreadsheets in Google Drive on my phone that I can look at and sort of guide me around the bookstore. Oh, look for this book or look for this author. And that's a thing that absolutely helps me. But also, to me, it is like a survey, like a class. Like, I feel like now I can talk more about sci-fi and fantasy as genres. And understand they're distinct genres, but they're both awarded by the Hugos. But so I know them better, and I have seen what other people generally consider to be some of the best of those genres, at least at the novel level.
Yeah.
And I feel like it makes me a better, you know, I blog about these books. I'm not a professional reviewer, but I want to take it seriously enough that I'm saying intelligent things, or that I have means of comparison. I have important reference points. You know, I might not have that if I didn't do a project like this one. And so, I'm not, even though I had to read some pretty terrible books along the way, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. And when you do that, one thing I noticed was, like, I did an episode on Rendezvous with Rama, and both of us were like, this feels like a 60s book. You know, it doesn't feel like it was in the 70s. But you know, you don't know that unless you've read all the winners from that era.
Right. Yes. Very fair. Yeah. Clark had his style. I mean, I think you can also see that the evolution over time of, you know, there was definitely a point where it was hard science fiction, sort of uber alles, right? Like that one. And, you know, that did continue at least into the 90s, I would say.
Yeah.
And whereas more recently, there's been a little more emphasis on things like plot and character.
Right.
And it's like, we're okay with the science being kind of iffy. And I am too. I actually would rather read, I like some of the hard sci-fi stuff, but you got to either give me a good plot or some really good characters to connect with.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking with a friend about this, about, you know, he's like, I come to science fiction because I want that sense of wonder about, you know, the future and technology and that kind of stuff. And he's like, the more recent stuff is more sociological, and that just doesn't do it for me. And, you know, your mileage may vary, right? That's, everybody looks for something different from their fiction.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Because I read a lot of literary fiction also, it is a little hard for me to go back. Rendezvous with Rama is a great example of a book that is revered, but to me, it's very dry.
Yeah.
It's very cold. You know, I remember nothing of the characters. I remember Rama.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there is that, like my friend was talking about that sense of wonder about what it would be like to stick your head into this, you know, hundreds of thousands of years old object and have no idea what's in there. And that's fun. It's fun to put yourself in that headspace, but you're not doing it because Clark is doing anything amazing with characters.
No, he's absolutely not. He never did. I've read, he win four? He's won several. I've read several of his. I've read enough of his books that, he's not great about characters. I mean, obviously the most indelible character he ever created is Hal.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time.
Yeah. Not a person.
Mm-hmm. Well, not a human.
Not a human.
Yeah.
That's true. That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in terms of, I mean, I know, you know, you like lists. I like lists as well. So kind of to put some framework on the conversation, I did want to talk about, you know, if there's any books that jump out as like lived up to the hype, ones that you hadn't read that you got to and you're like, yes, as built.
There's an immediate one for me, which is Hyperion.
Yep, that's right at the top of my list too.
Oh my God, because I didn't know much about it. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think it's a little undersold. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the problems that I think genre fiction has in general is that if somebody writes something that transcends genre, and I think we're really, we should be well past that, right?
Yeah.
But still we are. It's its own section in the bookstore, for example. Mm-hmm. They're sold differently. They're literally packaged differently. Mm-hmm. They show up in, you know, they're mass market paperbacks. They are, the covers look different. The fonts look different. And so I think that's part of why they are kind of, looked down upon as, lesser than literary fiction. Meanwhile, I love finding older copies of literary fiction works in mass market paperbacks because they're more portable, or because I feel like I'm grabbing a little piece of history because we just don't really do that anymore.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to Hyperion, to me, checked so many boxes. It's incredibly well written. Yeah. The characters are great. The setting is really into the plot, I would say in general, is really, really intelligent. Mm-hmm. Like it is, it's something else for sure.
Well, and you said about transcending genres too, and even within science fiction, Hyperion has its section of, sort of cyberpunk and sort of military science fiction, and like it's got something for everybody too.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It is. It's one of the most. I'm hesitating because I don't want to over superlative.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's definitely one of the most transcendent. This shows that science fiction or fantasy, I don't want to exclude fantasy, can be so much more. Like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which I knew was going to be good before I read it.
Yeah.
That was sort of a right into my veins type of book anyway. Mm-hmm. That was one where it's like, this is a novel.
Yeah.
Right. This is absolutely something completely different.
Yeah. That one is an undertaking.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. But I will say it's one of the fastest. Most of the 1,000 pages I've ever read, I think I've read 6 or 7 books in my life. Mm-hmm. It might be a little more than that were that long. And the only one that I would say was faster was The Executioner's Song. And that's a whole different genre of book, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway. Mm-hmm. That's... Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell it doesn't feel like a 1,000 pager, and it has some of the most absolutely incredible characters.
Yeah.
And some incredibly clever plotting. I mean, I lack the superlatives. I think I said it was my favorite book. I did a ranking on my blog of the 50 best books I've read that were written in this century, regardless of language or genre, just fiction. I think I actually had it first. It's my favorite.
Wow.
And yeah, I understand. It's a book about magicians, and a lot of people will be like, but you know what? It's brilliant. She's also doing different things. Like she's also lightly parodying and at the same time paying homage to a lot of 19th century British literature, which, obviously it's clear that this is a writer who grew up studying and or loving those genres. And that genre and that style of writing. And I think it is, and it really, really shows through in everything she's doing in the book. She's paying so much homage to that. And I enjoy it. I enjoyed that tremendously. Because I got it because I've read most of those. I've read all of Jane Austen and the main books by the Bronte sisters, like 5 books by Dickens and a bunch of his acolytes. Like going back to why do I read these lists? Mm-hmm. I've got, other lists that I've worked my way through that it's not worth talking about, but because it gives me such a foundation. Not only do I enjoy reading for reading, but now it's like, hey, I get the joke.
Right.
I'm in on this one. I actually understood this and that matters a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one for me, I mean, I really enjoyed that book. And, the footnotes are spectacular in that one.
Oh, they're
as well.
Amazing.
It's a thing all on its own. I'm not super well read in Victorian literature and that kind of stuff. And so, there's some of those references I'm definitely not going to get, but that's fine.
She actually beat David Foster Wallace at his own game, I would say, in terms of footnotes. Her footnotes are better.
Nice.
His footnotes are good. He has way too many of them, and some of them are just way too long. She did it better.
Okay.
Better, funnier. Yeah, I'm very much in.
Yeah. What did you think of Piranesi? I loved that one.
I loved it.
I voted for it last year in the Hugos. I was hoping that it would
win. Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. What ended up winning? Oh, Network Effect, which I was fine with.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually probably would have gone The City We Became, then Piranesi, then Network Effect.
Okay.
But they were all above the line for me. Mm. Whereas like the year before, I don't remember what the other nominees were, but like Memory Called Empire was like, really? Well, I read that one after it won. Network Effect I had read before. Mm-hmm. Often I'll go out and, you know, you see the short list. I'm like, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll go pick up a couple of these. And then I saw some of what was on the list this year. I was like, let's just wait and see what happens.
Yeah, that was kind of the approach I took this year as well. And I mean, to be fair, like comparing the way you consumed the list and the way I did, I'm reading almost exclusively, you know, science fiction for this podcast and for another podcast that I do. Whereas I know that you read a lot more widely. I know you get to travel a little more now, so that can.
Yes, well, that's the thing. Like, that's absolutely part of it. In fact, during the pandemic, I read less than I had read at any point since the year my daughter was born.
Yeah.
And the reason for that, very simply, was that I lost all my travel time. I read on planes and I have dead time at, you know, airports and, you know, waiting at ballparks for, you know, anybody else to show up or the game to start.
Pitching changes.
Freaking pitching change to stop. Oh God, those are like the death of me. Yeah. Are we really doing this?
Yeah.
All of the above.
Yeah.
And so like I've very much gotten back to that now. Because I'm traveling again. Mm-hmm. And so I have read this year, it'll be my highest number of books read since pre-pandemic because I've got all that time back and I've mixed it up. I tried to do some super long ones and finish some, like I read Blue Mars this year, mm-hmm. but also like get back to, you know, the other genre I love is any type of detective story, like classic detective stories. You know, I love Agatha Christie. I love, Nero Wolfe stuff. And I've been reading Georges Simenon, who's a French Inspector Maigret, is his author. And it's a different kind. I would say it's noir, but in a very different way. Mm. It's not so much hard boiled as it is more existentialist and a grim view of humanity. Mm. And I enjoy that too. And, you know, I've been mixing in a bunch more of those. I'm like, yeah, you know what? There's no reason not to read that stuff, right? I shouldn't feel bad. Nobody should feel bad about what they like to read. You like what you like.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm curious next year with the pitch clock. One thing that I do all the time is like I'll tell my wife I'm going to go watch a baseball game and read. And so I'll sit there in front of the baseball game, and between pitches I'm looking down and I'm reading a paragraph, and then I look back up, and you know, the pace of baseball, say what you will, and I know, you know, people who don't like it are like, oh, it's too slow, nothing happens. I'm like, mm-hmm. So it's still great. So with the pitch clock, it might be I might have to confine my reading to the commercial breaks.
Pitching changes and. You know, any replay.
Yeah.
Replay is the other one.
Yeah.
That just always.
Like
always
right
gets
now,
me.
In when I'm watching baseball games on Root Sports Northwest, you know, like between every pitch, they're showing a replay of the pitch with the pitch track data, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm like, the only reason they have this time is because, you know, the batter steps out and the pitcher goes through his whole routine.
Yep.
And yeah. It's not like the Nomar Garciaparra, you know, routine with his gloves like he used to do.
Or you're at least my age.
I think I'm a year or two older. I graduated.
So you remember Mike Hargrove, the human rain delay?
Oh yeah.
Yep. That's another one.
Yep. Okay. So sorry, back to books.
That's okay.
So other ones that you feel like really lived up to the hype.
So I didn't know Connie Willis, before I started this project of reading all the Hugos. I don't even know how many years ago it was. You know, I'd only read about 10, maybe. I'd read, you know, it's probably useful to say, like, I pulled up the list here. What had I actually read before I started any of this?
Yeah, I tried.
Anything Asimov. Mm-hmm. I had read some Heinlein, but I think none of his winners. I had read Dune. I've often said I read the whole series by Dad. Mm. By Frank Herbert.
Yeah.
Which was a very regrettable choice on my part.
I've heard that.
You know, just I always tell people, just read the first one and stop.
I got that advice from someone that I hold in very high regard now.
Yeah. But I had read, you know, and I still think the original Dune is brilliant. And for the record, I love the Villeneuve movie, and I can't wait to see the second half. Yeah. I thought it was awesome. I had read The Man in the High Castle. I had read, I think I said anything Asimov. I might have read The Dispossessed right before I started this, Ursula Le Guin, which is amazing. Both of her winners are incredible.
Yeah.
The Dispossessed and The Left Hand of Darkness. I go back and forth. I think I prefer The Dispossessed because I do enjoy a lot of dystopian novels, mm-hmm. and that is a different take on it. I mean, her voice, especially, is one of the few prominent women writers in what was such a white male dominated field for so long, especially at the time of her peak output. she produced two novels that won the Hugo that were so different than anything anybody else was writing.
Yeah.
Ender's Game. I had done Ender's Game, listened, I remember, as an audiobook way back. God, that was a long time ago. I was right. My daughter was a baby at that point. So we're talking 15 years ago. I remember liking it until the whole Speaker for the Dead thing. And it's like, we just went off the rails here. And turns out that was like a different book, right? He smushed two things together.
Right. Yeah. And it started as a novella and then he built it out to be a prequel to Speaker for the Dead. So, which I love. That's a book that's dear to me just because of the time in my life when I read it, where like I'd be sitting on a bench reading it while my son is playing on playground equipment down by the library. Like, that's just what I feel when I read it now, you know, that time. And my dogs are named Ender and Bean. So.
Ah, oh, very nice. Yeah. I'm just going back to your question. And obviously I'd read Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And American Gods, because Time Magazine, Lev Grossman, and I don't know if it was just him, but he'd done a thing that was like the 10 best books of the 2000s so far. And he did this maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I had read eight. I hadn't read Lush Life by Richard Price and American Gods. So I went out immediately, got American Gods, and loved it. I think it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
it's true. So, you know, that gives people a sense of what I'd come in having read. Jonathan Strange, as we talked about. Mm-hmm. So of stuff that I hadn't read before starting the list. Anything Connie Willis, adore her writing, flat out adore it. And she won for several books that are kind of different. They all involve her time travel universe.
Yeah.
And I love the way she does that. She does time travel in such a different way. It is such a small part of the story. Time travel is just the prime mover that sets the story in motion. Right. And I appreciate that. It is not the raison d'être of her books. The point of the books is I'm putting very recognizable characters in very recognizable, you know, in real situations, but adding this complication of sort of time out of joint or trying to get home. But it is very much about what happens to the people once they are there.
Yeah.
The other one I'll say is Joe Walton's Among Others, which is one of the least sci-fi fantasy. Like there's very little.
Right. Right. Very meta. But
yes. Yeah. Yes. So I think that book's absolutely amazing, beautifully written. Mm-hmm. Like it is, there's so much. There's very little that is anything else, fantasy, whatever you want to say. There's very little else. Very little that it's probably the least sci-fi or fantasy of any of the winners, I would think. There might be something from very early on, although a lot of the early on books just suck. Winners, I mean, because it was like, oh, cool sci-fi idea. And then that's it. And they forgot to put a story around it. Right. You know what? I will also say this is, they're a little, I have read, because of Lois McMaster Bulshold's won a couple times. She won for one of her fantasy novels, and I think three times for the Vorkosigan saga.
Yeah.
Those books are, they're fluffy. Oh, they're really fun. They're fun. That's great character. It's a really, really great character.
Yeah.
He's a scamp. He's a little ridiculous, but I'm very into it. Yeah. And I have read several of the others. Like I haven't actually this year because I've been just sort of reading a bunch of other things. But like, that's always in the back of my mind to get back to those. Those are fun.
Yeah.
Grab one from the library every now and then. I was trying to read them now, go back and read the remainder in order because it's like 16 or 17 in the whole
series. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's great. She's done a really nice job creating one incredibly compelling core character and a pretty interesting group sort of in his retinue or in his little universe.
Yeah.
And it becomes one of those where it's like, this sci-fi stuff. I don't care. Right. Yeah. I'm reading for this, you know, they're adventure novels.
Right. Yeah. Basically. Yeah. I mean, there's one that's literally like a murder mystery. I mean, it's the fact that it's set in, you know, on a different planet, you know, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter, right? Absolutely does not matter. To me, that is part, you know, that's part of her brilliance, I would say.
Yeah,
she's done a really tremendous job. Yeah,
those ones definitely I put in the pleasant surprise, right? Because I remember going back to talking about Speaker for the Dead, I discovered it on Books on Tape just to age myself a little bit. I had a car with a tape deck. And, you know, then I started working my way through the rest of that series and I kept passing because I was going to the seas, right? Orson Scott Card. And so I kept passing Bujold in there. I kept seeing, I saw the Vor game on there 100 times and never picked it up. And so then when I finally did, just really, really enjoyed those.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, absolutely great. I don't remember which one I read first actually, but
I think the first one you did on your blog was the Vore game.
It was probably the Vore game. Okay, yeah. I'm gonna go with what you said on that. And I know Bariar was later because he's not in it, right? Because he's being born, right? He's in utero at that point. I read Paladin of Souls early and I was like, this is the sword and sorcery stuff I never really got into.
Right.
Like, I don't like reading a book that feels like I'm reading someone's D&D campaign. I'm not anti role playing or anything. It's not like that. I don't personally play those. But I don't have any antipathy for them. It's just, I don't want to read that as fiction. But then I got into the war stuff. It's like, oh yeah, this is good. She just creates good characters. Yeah. I mean, I'm into that. If you put if you give me a really good character, you're halfway there.
Yeah.
I can read a lot of things that just focus on one really good character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With going back to Connie Willis, and this was something, you know, Connie Willis was not an author I was really familiar with either. I think I had seen Doomsday Book on lists, but I wasn't familiar with the rest of the series.
Fun story. My daughter she's junior in high school now. And for at least each of the last two summers, might be the last three, she was given a list for English class to pick one from this long list. And Doomsday Book has been on them, which I think is a fantastic. And I give them a lot of credit. There's some high quality genre fiction on the list as well as literary fiction.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty broad mix of, diverse authors and time periods and genres. And I saw that on there and I was, that's awesome, actually. Yeah. And there was another class, she's not in it, but it's the year before where or maybe it's a different class, like it's a class in world politics or something, where they have to read a different Kim Stanley Robinson, the guy who wrote the Mars trilogy, a different one of his novels. I was like, oh, thank God she's not in that class. For listeners who don't know, I can't stand the Mars trilogy. And it's funny because I also write a lot about board games. I play a lot of board games. And one of the most acclaimed board games the last 10 years is Terraforming Mars, which has spun off a bunch of expansions and related games. And they are explicitly based on the Kim Stanley Robinson novels.
Yeah.
And those games, especially the base game, it's long and it's complicated. And I would rather play that 10 times in a row than read another Kim Stanley Robinson novel.
Yeah. Let me finish off the surprises and things we like before we get
back. Yes. Sure.
I will say that reading Doomsday Book, I read it in 2020. And this is not an experience I necessarily recommend. It's a fantastic book. But it is not cheery. And
reading it
during a pandemic is not a ton of fun. It's amazing how prescient it was, though.
Oh, absolutely.
From the toilet paper hoarding to the people not wanting to wear masks, right. Americans not wanting to wear masks. That was
not wanting to wear masks.
Yeah. Amazing book. So,
yep.
So anything else that kind of, we've talked about ones that kind of lived up to the hype. You said you didn't know Connie Willis necessarily beforehand. So that is more like in the surprise category. Is there anything else that falls into that category where it's something that you didn't expect to be good?
I mentioned Joe Walton's, among others. Mm. That was a big surprise. It's not one of my favorites, but China Mieville's The City in the City.
Mm, yeah.
The concept. I cannot get away from how brilliant the concept is. I wish he'd executed it better in terms of a story.
Sure.
But this idea of two cities, I can think of probably 1,000 ways where he, I originally assumed it was inspired by maybe Jerusalem.
Yeah.
But you also think of, I forget the name of, there's that, a town that sits on the border between Belgium and the Netherlands, where the border like splits, like you and your neighbor could easily be in different countries.
Mm.
And the border actually runs through certain restaurants there. And so in his book, In the City in the City, it is two cities that essentially coexist in the same space. And you sort of have to know which city you're in.
Right.
And there is even a secret police that is watching to make sure that nobody breaches this invisible boundary between the two. It, utterly fascinating concept. I have probably thought of all the books on the list that I didn't actually love, it's the one I've thought about the most.
Yeah.
Because that is such a clever conceit. Maybe if it's not at the top, if I was just ranking the Hugo winners by concept, if it wasn't one, it would be really close.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always come back to, damn, I wish he pulled it off a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But the story was not that compelling. I remember nothing of the characters at all. And it's not that he's a poor writer. I've read Perdido Street Station, which I don't love also, but it's clear he's a talented writer.
Yeah.
He just didn't quite, it's not even stick the landing, because I think then the concept for the story didn't match the concept for the setting. And that, you know, if I sound frustrated, I am, because I have such respect for the imagination that came up with that setting in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. Keith, there's a version of this podcast where we talk about all the books, grading them at like a scout.
So yes, nice. Like
80 concept, 60 execution, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be an 80 concept and like 45 execution. I mean, it's so much worse. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to, overly ding him for it, but at the same time.
I'm kind of jumping off what you said about the concept there. Another it's really a series sort of that has two Hugo winners with really interesting concepts is the Zones of Thought series, the Werner Vinge stuff, A Deepness in the Sky and A Fire Upon the Deep.
Yes.
Really enjoy that concept of the thoughtless depths and like the whatever the singularity is up at the top. Really, really interesting. And I enjoyed both those books.
Yeah. Too long. The thing I keep coming back
they
to.
They are kind of long.
Just too damn long.
Yeah.
And they don't merit their length, right? I spoke about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which I think is the longest ever to win. Mm-hmm. And I have no issue with its length. And, you know, let's not talk about J.K. Rowling the person, but as an author, right? She wrote several very long books that I absolutely enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I've read at least a half dozen books of 1,000+ pages ever. I've read Bleak House, I'm sure there are people who are like, Bleak House is too long. I'm like, no, it's actually just right. It is just right. The length is just right. So that's not so much my issue with those, but I don't think Vinge merits the length. Mm-hmm. Okay. I feel very dispassionate about his books. I've read, he's won three, two in that setting, and then Rainbow's End is totally separate and quite prescient in other ways, actually. Yeah. Like a pretty good foresight into where wearable tech especially is going. But all three of those, he's a hard sci-fi guy, right? He's an Arthur Clarke, where it's very much, I'm going to create technology or science, a science setting, an astronomical setting, something like that. That is the reason I write the book, as opposed to I'm going to create a great story in these settings. And I think he and Robinson are a bit throwbacks in that way to the earliest winners, right? You go back to the very beginning of this and you have a bunch of, I actually like Heinlein too, but like his books largely are, I mean, honestly, I think a lot of his books read now more like stuff for teenage boys.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of them that are just juveniles, right?
Juvenile. Yeah. And it's funny because a lot of them now I look and I'm like, wait, which one is this? Is this for grown-ups or is this not for grown-ups? Should I feel bad about reading it? No, just read it, right? There's nothing wrong with adults reading YA fiction. Right. Also, I'm fine. I have no issue with that at all. But there are a bunch of those early winners. And they're not all, but there are a bunch of those that are so hard science that I have a very hard time. It's not that I hate them necessarily. I hate the Robinson books. Obviously, we're going to end up probably talking about that more. But it is that I end up feeling no connection at all to the stories. And he's like that. Vinge is a bit more like that, where, again, I might remember certain things. Which was the one? Was it The Deepness in the Sky with the wolf pack where they essentially
share? No, that's
A
Fire Upon the Deep.
That's A Fire Upon the Deep. Yeah. Okay, see, this is how much I connected with him. I can't even keep the books apart. He had a great idea there.
Yes.
The idea of the wolves who essentially operate on a single consciousness.
With an emergent consciousness, kind of.
Very, very clever.
Yeah.
Very clever. That could have been the basis for a pretty interesting novel of half its length.
Sure.
And instead, we just get all this other stuff going on and he's created a pretty wide universe. I actually assumed that there would probably be like a half dozen books in this universe that he created because it is so rich. And I think it's just the two. Maybe he's written other short stories.
No, there's The Children of the Sky that kind of picks up Fire Upon the Deep. I haven't read it yet. But it's all about the wolves. And that was by far the most interesting part of that book for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of them, again, something very, very clever. It's like, why did people love Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie? Because she had it was a new concept.
Yeah.
It was just a new idea. I thought that book was good. I didn't think it was amazing, but I thought it was very good. I did not feel compelled to continue the series. which I know a lot of people did. And I, you know, I could have, but, it wasn't like, where some of these were, it's like, I'm never reading that author again. But it was, hey, you got a pretty good idea there. That's good. I'm always impressed when somebody comes up with a different idea. I mean, to me, that's the network effect thing, which I know that wasn't her first. She had several short stories, but again, an interesting concept.
Yeah.
And when you take that and then pull it forward into good characters, good plot. Yeah. Then I'm interested.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to be much more engaged. I remember a lot more out of it. Whereas some of these I read, and like I said, the only thing I remember about Rendezvous with Rama is Rama. Mm-hmm. And that's not a thing. Well, it's a thing. It's not a person.
Right.
Or character.
Yeah. Yeah. I, one of the others that was kind of a surprise for me, was Way Station, by Clifford Simak.
That
really enjoyed. That's another one where it's kind of all about the setting and the relationship between, I think it was like the mailman and the main character. And it was just sweet. I'm on record with, I like a good downer ending if it's earned, right? If it makes sense.
Right.
But that one just, like, it just made me smile and just really enjoyed that whole set.
Yeah. Have you read any of his other stuff? And I think that's the only thing he won for. But
there's no other winners from Simak.
Yeah. But he's popped up. I always get confused because that one has two titles. He pops up every now and then on, like, his books will be $2 for the Kindle.
Yeah.
And I do buy a lot of books that way. Generally, if I buy a physical book, I try to buy it from either bookshop or I go to an independent bookstore.
Yeah.
But I will admit, I have a Kindle.
Yeah. It's hard to resist a $2 book.
A $2 book, right? At that point, because, you know, then it's, I don't even have to deal with the library or, like, you know, when I go to Fall League, it's going to be almost a week. Mm-hmm. Do I really want to carry a week's worth of books? I mean, trust me, I used to.
Yeah.
But it's nice to have a few to throw on the Kindle. His pop up, and I never actually pulled the trigger because I just don't know anything about them. But I will say, I liked Way Station. It was funny because they had a run there where consecutive years it was Stranger in a Strange Land, The Man in the High Castle, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Way Station, then Fritz Lieber's The Wanderer, which I could totally do without, and then Dune the year after, which
very
tied
different
with
books.
Yeah, very different books. And that's the thing. That's the point where if I'd been alive and a fan at the time, it would have been like, oh, this award just got really interesting. Actually, preceding Stranger in a Strange Land was A Canticle for Leibowitz, which truly stands out to me as, oh my God, this is a book. You know, obviously he, the author, had a lot of problems himself.
Yes.
But this is way out of time.
Like, yeah.
You know, people weren't producing that kind of fiction, let alone finding a large audience for that at the time. You know, and you think it's religious / anti-religious themes, although he was a religious man himself. Like, you know, you could read that on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. That is, there was a run there that probably I would say ended with, I wasn't a big Lord of Light fan. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I know Zelazny has his
acolytes.
That's probably the part where he won. I think I liked And Call Me Conrad a little bit more.
Mm.
And then The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, 67. That was my, of the four Heinlein winners, that's probably my least favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where things sort of tapered off for a few years. Stand on Zanzibar, which was sort of like hysterical fiction. Interesting. You know, and there, then you could see that the turn into the 70s where Le Guin starts winning and Rama pops up and Asimov wins. I guess that was his first, which is kind of amazing to me. The guy wrote 500 books. He only won two Hugos, but I guess there's other writers out there. Fine. he won for The Gods Themselves, which is actually not, I've read probably 30 or 40 of his novels, and I wouldn't say that was one of his better ones.
I don't think that one stands out as a particularly good winner. I mean, I enjoyed the book, and it's an interesting concept, right, with the separate universes.
That's the leaking into the, right, from one universe into the other. Yeah. It's an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I put down on my list of surprises because I had never heard anybody say anything good about They'd Rather Be Right, and it's not good.
Oh, it's not good.
But it's not nearly as bad as I thought. Like, it's a book of one idea, not executed particularly well, but it's fine. It had the good grace to be short.
Very. Oh, yeah. I read it really quickly. Isn't it like it's two things smushed together also? Is that another one? It's such a – it is a bit of a mess.
Yeah, yeah.
You're right about the concept. Yeah. Two professors create an advanced cybernetic brain.
Right.
Which is – I'm trying to figure out what the story was. Yeah, originally published as a four-part serial.
Yeah.
And it's like, it I think they changed the order, right? Yeah, so that's what it was. It was, it's been published in multiple editions.
That's right.
At one point, it was published with two prequel stories in it titled The Forever Machine. I think that might actually be, that might be the one I read.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm pretty sure I read the story Crazy Joey. Yeah, so that's what I'm thinking of, right? Where it's not even clear that there is a single canonical version of this, which adds to the confusion.
Yeah,
I agree with you that it's an interesting concept. It is not well executed, and there was a huge controversy over it, over why it won, and a lot of people say it's the worst winner. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, lowest quality winner, we're probably in the ballpark, but if you're saying like which books would you least want to read or least recommend, it's not the worst for me. There's several others where I was like, I mean, I also don't like CJ Cherry's books. I think she's just a dreadful writer.
I've been trying to figure that out because I hear people rave about her books, and I enjoyed both Cytene and Down Below Station. I ultimately enjoyed them, but they were hard to get through.
Oh, she is a dry, joyless, and sometimes fairly pedantic writer. Down Below Station is a better concept for me. She's an author who's very tied up in her world building, or universe building, I guess. And I'm not a huge fan of that. Like, to me, I would prefer, you know, this isn't truly a binary construct, but, you know, just to proceed to the dichotomy for a second, there are, you know, the sci-fi and fantasy authors who just get very wrapped up in, I'm going to build this incredibly ornate world, setting, universe, whatever.
Yeah.
And that becomes the driving force. And there are those who clearly I prefer, where it's, no, this is, I'm just going to do this at the start and wind up the characters and let them go in this giant universe that I've built and not spend much time continuing to build out the universe or explain the universe. I feel like Cherry spends so much time explaining her universe and what these planets are and how they became independent of the planets before, et cetera. So I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Right. Just give me the people back. And, you know, was it Cytene? Cytene's the one I think I actually put down and went back to like 3 months later. And I was like, I'm going to push myself to finish this. It was so close to the end.
Yeah.
It was the last non Kim Stanley Robinson book I had to read. So that was, I can't with writers like that. To me, that's when people think sci-fi is not literature, I think they're often thinking of that. It's just this dry, science-y stuff, which, you know, a lot of people would say, well, this appeals to the 13-year-old kid who's like, you know, imagining the stars and drawing maps of things or building, you know, spaceships in his head, like, or her head.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But to me, that's not literature. That is not of the quality of Connie Willis, who creates the, you know, I keep coming back to her because I think she's such a brilliant prose writer.
Yeah.
And also she created her little time travel. This is how time travel works in my universe. And that's it. I'm never touching anything else again. I'm building the stories around that. Mm-hmm. And then it's all about character.
Yeah. Well, what's so brilliant too about that series is, you know, it's built out and, you know, there's these theories you can't make any changes. You can't break the net or anything. And then you get into Blackout and All Clear and they're like, we broke it. We think we're broken, but that's the, you know, it's the third book in the series. Well, third and fourth. Yeah. And so it's earned that way. Cause you're like, ooh, boy, is it possible that they really screwed something up here? And, and that's one of the more pleasant 1,000 pages I've ever spent is reading Black.
Oh my God. It's amazing. So. Yeah. Right. Cause it is, they were awarded, you know, for folks who don't know, that was awarded a single Hugo. They're published as two separate books because it would have been enormous.
Oh, I would have been so pissed off if I would have been reading those at the time and I finished the first one.
Oh, my God, yes. And so, wait a minute, we're not done. What? Yeah, we're not done? What happens?
Yeah.
You know, fortunately, you're so invested at that point. It's three characters sent back from, you know, some point in the near future to us today, sent back to World War II London, who get stuck there.
Stuck in the Blitz,
Stuck in the Blitz. And it is, so it's three really, really beautifully written, beautifully crafted, written. Oh my God. And you're so invested in them. And who's going to, and you know, at the start, like you can't, not everyone, these three stories are not all ending happily.
Yeah.
That's just not possible. Mm-hmm. And she's not that kind of writer.
Yeah.
So you're trying to figure out, well, okay, what ends where? And I mean, it wasn't until very, very close to the end that I was like, oh, this one's not ending.
Yeah.
You know, and she still ties it. You know, like you said, I'm good with a bad, with a sad or unhappy ending.
Yeah.
You got to earn it. She earned the hell out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. For me. Big time. All right. I think, you know, we've been talking about some letdowns. You know, for me, a book that let me down because of its reputation. And then I read it and I was like, it's just not working for me, was Neuromancer. And it may be that just, you know, I haven't been super connected to science fiction my entire life, right? I've gotten nerdier as I've gotten older. And so
you
like
just
cyberpunk,
embraced it.
What's that?
You just embraced it.
I just embraced it. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's always been there. But yeah, it's just like there was something about that book. And that was one of those ones where I read the book and then I was listening to the audiobook as well, kind of filling back in, like, did I miss something? And I don't know, maybe one of these days I'll give it another try and it'll really work for me. But yeah, that was a tough one.
That's interesting. Cause that's one of the ones I read before starting the list. I read that. Mm-hmm. I actually could tell you, I read it before my daughter was born. So we're talking 17 years ago, maybe that I read it. And, I liked it. I got on its wavelength very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then I read the two sequels and it was like, nope.
Yeah.
It was just, that was a one-time thing, right? We hit it. He got it. He got in, he got out, and that's it. And I'm not any more of this. Also, to me, I read that, I don't know, probably not long after I saw The Matrix. I was like, oh, this is the good one.
Yeah.
Right? This is way better. I'm not a Matrix guy. I've only seen the first movie. I have no interest in continuing anywhere in the series. I was like, The Matrix, it was one good idea and then some cool special effects.
Yeah.
Whereas Neuromancer is a novel built around a pretty similar idea.
Sure.
And done better and with more than one interesting character. But I also can understand, like, that's pretty, like, that really stands out to me as very different than certainly anything else that won within plus or minus 10 years, right? You might find a little more of, I feel like he influenced probably Network Effect and that whole series.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know if she's ever said that, but Martha Wells being the author of Network Effect. But like, you can see that, whereas I look around him in Winners and it is, you know, more traditional sci-fi like David Brin's books or fantasy. There's nothing to me even remotely comparable to Neuromancer at any point there. And he was, you know, I wonder what it was like to read that at the time. You know, 1985, there was no internet. I mean, there was, but nobody knew what it was, right? And for him to then be talking about hackers and people plugging their brains into a worldwide connected network probably blew some minds. Would have blown, you know, teenage me, I wasn't even a teenager, I was 12. You know, I would have been like, this is the greatest thing ever. How do I do this, right? And that's and that's not a criticism per se, but I also know that that's the type of book and the type of setting where a lot of people would be like, that's for kids.
Yeah.
It's not totally wrong. It's somewhat for kids.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. The Uplift series is another series that I had a hard time connecting to.
It's fine. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I always say I have a short use for poetry or song in my prose fiction. And
agreed.
And with the dolphins, you know, I like the idea of the whole trinary language and that kind of stuff. I as a concept, I like it. But with the execution where it's these weird triplets of things, I'm like, I can't even with the dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. It's probably another one where it's decent idea.
Yeah.
God, I've only read those two books of his, I think. Star Tide Rising, right? And The Uplift War. Mm-hmm. And Uplift War is really another one that's just way too long. Are we ever getting anywhere? And that's another one I started, put aside. It's funny. I remember starting it and I was sick. I was very sick when I started trying to read it and got, I don't know, 20 pages in. I was like, boy, this is terrible. Then I tried it again and I didn't have a fever of 102 and it somehow was better at that point. He's another one who I feel like gets overly enamored with his creations, right? I came up with this great idea of there are three, right? There are three species that have been uplifted. Well, two.
Just on
humans,
Earth. Yeah.
And then they, right? Yeah, just on Earth, right? Yeah. To sort of, you know, sentience, greater level of, you know, or consciousness. Consciousness is the word.
Sapiency, yeah.
See, yes, exactly. And then I don't really love what he does with it at all. It's just not that interesting to me. And, you know, that those are also novels to me that those win in the 80s.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be winning anymore.
Sure, sure. And there were moments in each of those books that I did enjoy. I think the biggest mistake that I made was I read Sundiver first, which is the first in that series, and I did not like it at all. And so that kind of set me on a
– Yeah, you're
I'm
screwed.
Not sure about this. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know what? I'll give you one that I found kind of disappointing is Neal Stephenson won for The Diamond Age, and I think that book's kind of a mess.
Okay.
Like, he is full of ideas.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, Snow Crash, incredibly influential. To me, Snow Crash is the more expansive neuromancer, right? He's doing a lot of stuff, and again, very prescient, but it's all over the place. And the Diamond Age was even more all over the place.
Yes.
And it just doesn't, like, that's one of the few winners on here. And I say this about a lot of other fiction. It's like, he needed an editor. Somebody needed to be like, no, condense, tighten. You might need to cut. Maybe this is a short story set in the same universe, but instead it's just ideas. And it's very hard to hold that together. Whereas, you know, again, you go back to Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, where that's 1,000 pages, but it's tight. It's really, really tight. She's following a small set of characters in a pretty condensed setting, and she holds it together extremely well.
Yeah. I often say about The Diamond Age that basically, like, Neal Stephenson was like, okay, like, made a list of everything you can do with nanotechnology and
right.
just, like, threw it all at the wall.
Yes, exactly.
And I mean, I did end up enjoying that one, but it took me 3 tries to get through it.
Oh, so, wow. Yeah. Wow. What did you think of The Calculating Stars, which won 3 years ago?
I enjoyed it. I like the concept of it. The fact that it's an alternate universe and it doesn't just hinge on one difference, right? Because it was already in an alternate universe before meteor strike or whatever it was that precipitated everything. And so, yeah, I did enjoy that. And just because I'm interested in the history of the space race and, you know, how it might have gone differently. So that one worked pretty well for me.
I hated that.
Oh, really?
That is very, very near the bottom to me. That is a book written for children. It is so, so poorly written, but not well crafted, but extreme. That was a book that felt like it was written by a teenager.
Interesting.
And I was like angry from the beginning. And I know there's like, she was president of the Science Fiction Writers Association, all sorts of, did she win because of political, not that she did something untoward, but because of the position she had and the connections she had. That book sucks. Like, I would absolutely say that's a bottom 5 Hugo winner for me. And it's embarrassing that it won now. Like, I'm fine with saying, hey, this book that won 30 years ago, that hasn't aged well.
Sure.
That's not great. But like, science fiction and fantasy have come such a long way as genres and garnered far more mainstream acceptance. You look at N.K. Jemisin, you know, winning 3 times, nominated again for The City We Became. The sequel to that is coming soon. She is a very successful, highly acclaimed mainstream author now who happens to work in the field of science fiction. That's where this is as a genre.
Sure.
And, you know, then I read The Calculating Stars. I'm like, well, you just set us back 10 years. Good job. I mean, that book was, to me, it was embarrassing how juvenile the whole thing felt to me, and I was angry. And then, you know, especially for that to come on the heels of Jemisin winning with the three-peat, the only person to win 3 times in a row, the only person to win for all books in a series, like multiple firsts. And it's like, hey, you know, and that garnered a lot of positive mainstream attention as well.
Yeah.
And so then to go from that to, oh yeah, now we're reading a book that could have won in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
Made me kind of angry.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like a throwback. I'll give you that. Yeah, the Jemisin series. I'm actually my next episode is going to be on the third in that book, and that is a well crafted trilogy. Just like there's mysteries in there that you're not even sure are mysteries until you get to the third book, and I really like the way that's crafted.
That's really clever. Yeah. I mean, she had some really clever things in that. I actually would take The City We Became over all 3 books of that series. I feel like she really hit her stride. Like,
okay.
Good for her for winning those awards. I do not begrudge any of that.
Yeah.
Those are good books and they're clever and they're important. And her winning multiple times, I think said a lot for, and obviously there's a lot of controversy over that stuff too. So they're, you know, undeserved, unrelated to her. Okay. This is maturing as a space now. And that's great.
Mm-hmm.
The City We Became to me was like, oh, now we are, wow. She just took another huge step forward in character, especially.
Okay.
Character and plot, I would say, because it's obviously nowhere near the complexity or creativity of the setting
sure.
of the Broken Earth trilogy. But instead, it's, you know, that's more of a, I had this one really good conceit, and now I'm going to build stories within this universe I've created and just let the universe sort of run on its own. And yeah. I really, really appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The city I can't wait for the next book.
Yeah. The City We Became was one that I gave up on after a while. I just wasn't quite gelling.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, I prefer mm-hmm. science fiction to fantasy, and that was definitely a different sort of fantasy-ish thing, right? Emergent city intelligence kind of thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know. If it won, I was going to be like, okay, well, I guess I'll go back and revisit that one. And it didn't. So we'll see right. what happens with the next one. If the next one wins, then I'm going to have to do my homework. And
you're going to have to read some.
Yeah. so yep. we'll see. But that was, yeah, that's why I was hoping for Piranesi, because I read that one and just loved it. But,
yep.
One of the ones that I have left on my list is The Wanderer, and I've not heard that many good things about it. And I didn't really enjoy The Big Time by the same author, mm-hmm. Fritz Leiber. Mm-hmm. I've covered the Retro Hugos as well, and so I actually did enjoy Conjure Wife. It's kind of silly, but it was fun, and we did it for my other podcast where we talked about adaptations, because it's been adapted 3 times.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, one of the adaptations was originally called Weird Woman, because weird has sure. a connotation of witch.
Yes.
Like Harry Potter, the Weird series, right? Or Weird yep. Sisters.
Weird Sisters. So,
yeah. Yep. Yeah. So kind of getting down to the bottom of the letdowns, The Mars series is right up to, I mean, they're down at the bottom for me. I tried so many times to read Red Mars, mm-hmm. and I couldn't do it. And, eventually on all those books, I was just like, fine, I'll let somebody else read it to me. I'm just going to do audio for this. Cause I can't do it. I understand people love the books because of the hard science fiction parts of it that are then mined for things like terraforming Mars. And it's great that he did all that homework. It's just, there were a bazillion characters. I had no idea who any of them were, other mm-hmm. than like one of them was missing a finger, I think, at some point. And I'm like, okay, that's that one.
Oh yeah. You can't keep anybody, almost anybody straight.
Yeah.
In those novels. And I read all three. Now, granted, I read them a little bit apart from each other.
Yeah.
So Red Mars won the Nebula, yeah. not the Hugo. And
right.
Green and Blue won the Hugos. And I'm actually looking at the Nebula list because I wanted to be able to actually answer that question. I don't think he won for Green didn't win.
Yeah.
And I don't think Blue, God, did Blue even get nominated? Blue wasn't even nominated for the Nebula. So good job, Nebula.
Yeah.
Where I think I don't have any particular reason why I picked the Hugos over the Nebulas. It's just kind of where I started with, but
yeah.
I think there's a couple of Nebula winners, which are pretty dubious also. But so sure. anyway, but Robinson is to me the sort of absolute ultimate example of somebody who is far more interested in telling you about his world mm-hmm. than about story or character. And, you know, I don't want to cast aspersions on his character, but certainly as an author, it comes off as, look how clever I am. Look sure. how much I know about science and philosophy and this and that. I'm like, shut up. Just stop lecturing me. I'm not interested in any of this. And it just gets worse as the series goes on. If I had to rank them, I'd actually say Green is the best. Green is the most like a story. And then in Blue, he just goes right back to where he was in Red, except this time it's less about the terraforming stuff or the science stuff. And then there's all this stuff about, like, for example, philosophy and other areas of science. And I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, this is not interesting. It's the longest book of the three. Mm-hmm. It's like, talk about somebody who needed an editor. Somebody needed to go to him. It's like, this needs to be half its length. Sure. There is so much just extraneous material in here that is explanatory. Stop lecturing your audience. This isn't a college class, right? We're yeah. reading a book here. And he is, I mean, it's just insufferable. You know, nobody wants to, I shouldn't say nobody. I think very few people who approach works of fiction are there for digressions that just show off the author's knowledge. I'm sure Kim Stanley Robinson is extremely, extremely intelligent.
Yeah.
You don't need to tell me how intelligent you are right. in your books. Just show me through your writing.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, there is an audience that eats that up, and
yeah,
more power to them. I'm glad they were able to enjoy it. I'd get to where, you know, I literally started the audiobook for Blue Mars, I think, and it said like 29 hours. So she's like,
yeah. Oh my God. It's a freaking lifetime.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, again, to me, it feels it is. I wonder if it was one of those, like, we got to finish the trilogy. You won awards for the first two books.
Yeah.
Do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Just let it go. And you know what? To me, there is a part of me that thinks, now I don't know that, you know, 12, 13 year old me would have stayed with a book that's this long and this dry, but I would have loved the world building stuff. Like, as a kid, that was the stuff that I absolutely loved. Why did I love the Foundation series as a teenager? I think the thing that first pulled me in was the incredible universe that Asimov created in the original trilogy, especially. Mm-hmm. You know, and looking back, were his characters as good as I thought they were? Probably not.
Yeah.
But he was also a much better writer.
Yeah.
At least in terms of readability, maybe not in terms of beauty of prose, but in terms of his ability to propel the reader through the content. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he had it all day.
Yeah.
And Robinson was really bad at that, is really bad at that. And somehow he keeps writing and people keep giving him awards. And I mean, I don't begrudge. If you like him, Stanley Robinson, you want to buy his books, great.
Yeah.
Great. You do you. When it comes to awards, though, that's not the best this space has to offer.
Yeah. I feel like if Asimov had written that series, he would have ended it after the first generation. That's always been my thing about the Foundation trilogy is here you introduce this concept where you're going to shorten the Dark Ages to 1,000 years, and then you only show us 300 years.
Right.
So that was kind of wild, but. Yep. And those books have never been super high on my list. I actually, you know, I feel like a heretic when I'm like, I liked Foundation's Edge better than the original trilogy.
And that's the one that won.
Yeah.
He actually won for that.
Yeah. I think the reason for that is the other books were fix-ups, right? They were serialized and then they were fixed up into novels, where Foundation's Edge was written as a novel. And so to me, it was just a little more, there was the same characters from the start to the finish. And that really worked for me better than, you know, having, here's the Salvador Hardin days and here's the, you know, whoever else, you know, in the Foundation books.
The best part of the, just speaking of the five Foundation novels that Asimov actually wrote as Foundation novels, I know there's the longer time frame, right?
Yes.
It's The Mule.
Yes.
Which absolutely. Is a separate, which is like a novella and I believe is in the second book of the five. That's the best.
Yes.
That's an incredible story. I remember having an argument with a friend in high school. He was like, didn't you know who the mule was? And I was like, no, actually I didn't. I think I was just so wrapped up in the story. I wasn't even thinking about it.
Yeah.
I was just totally enraptured by this crazy space chase that he created that was super, super compelling. And, you know, it's some of the best that he can do.
Yeah. What's so great about that is that, and I don't have The Mule particularly far up my list. It's one of the retro winners. And, you know, just the Foundation books are not my favorite thing. But what's so brilliant about that character is the idea that here you set up this thing, which I have a hard time accepting, psychohistory anyway. But then, you know, you could throw a monkey wrench into it with, okay, now here's a character who can completely screw up everything because of his mental abilities. And that's fantastic. That it raises the stakes. And immediately, when you have that first time where the Selden vault opens and he says, here's the things that should be happening and none of it's happening. Then you're like, ooh, okay. How are they going to recover? Very cool.
Yep. It's funny. I haven't read much Asimov as an adult. That was one where, you know, between the ages of probably 15 and 25, read almost all the Asimov I will probably ever read. It's not like he has major works of fiction that I haven't read.
Right.
I'm not going to go back and reread them. Not that I didn't enjoy them, but there's too many other books to read. I reread very little. You know, I wonder, would I view them very differently if I read them now?
Yeah.
I mean, I just remember being in the bookstore in Walden Books in Smith Haven Mall on Long Island and seeing Foundation. And I knew who Asimov was. I'd actually read one of his books on algebra. When I was in middle school and needed to, you know, it's a long story. But anyway, so I pulled Foundation off the shelves and read the back of it. I was like, this is fucking awesome. Oh my God, what is this? Holy cow. And then I grabbed the book and I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked. That was very much the right book for me at that age. Would I feel differently now? Maybe I'd still love it. I don't know. But it's very hard to say what I liked at 15. I think that's how old I was versus now I'm 49. I definitely, and I am better read now. I've read so much more and I've read so much more literature and I've read from far more countries and a much more diverse group of authors. You know, think back to what you read in high school. It was almost all white authors.
Yeah.
And it was almost all male authors. There were some exceptions, but not enough, certainly. And it was very, very Eurocentric. In fact, when we read non-European or American authors, it was history class. It wasn't in English class. Remember reading Nectar in a Sieve and, oh my God, what was the other one that, oh, Things Fall Apart, which is obviously classic, and Spring Moon. Yeah, I think those were the three we read in history class, and they always stand out because that was the one, you know, at the time it was like, why are we reading these? I hate these, blah, blah, blah. Things Fall Apart's amazing. I reread that as an adult. Mm-hmm. But also it's like, thank God we did.
Yeah.
It's the rare example of us reading works that were by authors who were not, at least by birth, European or American.
Right.
And so I would, you know, now I've read so much more from around the world, would I think very differently about some of these novels that I read when I was much younger, particularly the Asimov novels, or some, not necessarily winners, but, you know, some of the Heinlein novels I read when I was younger, or the Dune trilogy. I think I'd probably still love, not trilogy, series, but I think I'd probably still love the original.
Yeah.
Especially how much I like the movie. But yeah, we change. We change as readers mm-hmm. as we get older, and what we like and what we look for changes as well. And I feel like every book I read, you know, changes the way I read in the future a little bit. And that's a good thing. But it also means that as we put together our own lists and our rankings, they are snapshots of moments in time, and they try to capture, it is a 2D rendering of a 3D experience, maybe a 3D rendering of a 4D experience, mm-hmm. traveling through time, right, on this rock. So it is very interesting to me to look back at my own reading and my own lists and say, I don't know if I'd feel the same way now. It's a different world.
That's one interesting, I think, one thing about your, like Claw 101 or whatever it is that you've done. I think it is 101.
Yeah. I really need to redo that.
I feel like you've re-ranked stuff over time.
It changes. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it has to. And I tried it, you know, it's very hard to go back and think, do I like this now?
Right.
Less than I liked it, but I haven't reread it. But you think differently about stuff and the book, the way a book hit me. I try to think, did that book hit me differently because it was the right book at the right time or the right book at the wrong time?
Sure.
It's very true. And, you know, I don't mind being out of step with some critical consensus. It's literature. It's like art.
Yeah. Right?
We're all going to disagree. It's fine. You know, and I hate books people love, and I love books that a lot of critics really disliked. And that's fine, right? You like what you like, and nobody should really apologize for liking things that they like, unless you like, you know, James Patterson. Those aren't books. Those are pamphlets. But, you know, that's to me that is part of the difficulty, but also the pleasure of producing lists like that for readers.
Yeah.
Come back to me and say, hey, Keith, I read books on your list and I liked this and I didn't like this. And have you checked out this book? And have you checked out this author? Like, this is what we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is all for fun. I mean, you do your podcast, I'm sure, for fun because you like that. You love this genre.
Yep.
And it's a great, you know, the awards. Is the list of Hugo winners some canonical list of the greatest science fiction ever produced? Of course not.
Yeah, it's a snapshot of a year, right?
Yeah, it's a great place to start the conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of which, I picked up The Master and Margarita a while back when it was cheap for the Nook. So one of these days I'll get to it. So
awesome.
When I have more time to read.
That'll happen sometime soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, cool. I have on the podcast website, it's just called Seth's Running Ranking. So every time I finish one, I slot it into where I think it falls. But I've never re-ranked any of the others. And so when I was going back to prepare for this, I was like, you know, is that one's a little further down than I thought it would be. Or that one might be a little further up than I thought. So one of these times, maybe I'll go back and try and re-rank them. But we'll see. I think that probably about wraps it up, Keith.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool.
This has been good.
Yeah. Thank you so much for doing it. I really, really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
And I'll look forward. I don't know if you're planning on putting something up on Metal Party with your rankings at some point.
Eventually. Yes. I got to get into the off season and, you know, just let's get us through, get me through free agent rankings.
There we go. Okay.
And then I get some time. Nice. By that point, I'm starting the 3-month process of doing the prospect rankings. And it's a little easier for me to say, I'm going to sit down, take an hour and write something longer for myself.
Yeah.
So that is my hope, is do something, whether it's Hugo rankings or my all time novels ranking, stuff like that. Like, we're hitting into that off season time where it's just much easier for me to say, I have a moment. I'm not planning the next trip.
Yes. Yeah. Awesome. Well, this gives people a little preview of part of what your list will look like.
So very much so.
If they want to see the completed list, they need to head over to metalparty.com/blog and keep an eye on that space. Follow you on Twitter at Keith Law, right?
Yep. That's the best place to find me.
Perfect. Cool. All right. Well, thanks again, Keith. This was a ton of fun.
Sure thing. Take care. Bye.